It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one, and share it with a friend if you like it. Today, my guest is Josh Krashauer, who has been for quite some time the columnist writing the Against the Grain column for National Journal, a place that he's been in a number of different roles over the years. He's just recently announced that he's going to be going to Axios to write a new newsletter for them. He is someone who is very aware of the different electoral and policy issues that are being debated in Washington. And we had a conversation about both what to expect from Republicans in the Senate after they've made the decision that they have on this gun issue, and the travails of the White House, which seems really incapable of navigating the current moment. Josh Krashauer coming up next.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Josh Krashauer, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Hey, great to be here, Ben.
There's a number of different developments that have been happening recently on Capitol Hill that I wanted to touch on with you. But first off, I wanted to congratulate you on your run as the Against the Grain columnist and in other roles at National Journal, where you are currently wrapping things up before jumping over to Axios. Run us through a little bit about your tenure there.
Well, thank you, Ben. I've been at National Journal for over 12 years, and the Against the Grain column has lasted that long. And look, I started it sort of on a whim that I just felt that a lot of political coverage, political analysis was very, very conventional, very stale, didn't focus on the voters, didn't look at, you know, what voters were saying. And that was the period of time where you saw a lot of grassroots blowback to what the party establishments were doing in Washington, and sort of a disconnect between the elites in Washington and what was going on actually on the ground in many states and jurisdictions. So I like to joke that some of it was grain and some of it was against the grain. You can't be contrarian all the time, but I tried to report with the best sources on both sides of the aisle and try to just break through the conventional coverage and come up with some independent insights about what's really happening in our politics. And I'm still going to be doing that at Axios. It's not going to change. My sensibility is going to be the same, but it's going to be under a different title, a different brand, and it's going to be a newsletter that I'm going to be doing on Sundays starting next month. So I'm very excited about that.
You know, I think that one of the difficulties, and this is a criticism that I hear about Washington and Washington coverage whenever I'm outside of DC, is people really feel like it's out of touch. They feel like it doesn't get what's really going on in the country. What do you think needs to happen journalistically in order to change that? Do you believe that that's a legitimate problem? And to what degree can the media go about altering their coverage in ways that will, you know, cut through a lot of that conventional mindset that, you know, really removes a lot of things that have become real outcomes in recent years from the realm of possibilities?
So there are a few things on my mind to that point. I think one thing is to focus on diversity, and not just racial and demographic diversity in terms of race and ethnicity, but also in terms of ideology and class, and not just hiring Ivy League students from the top schools, but to focus on state schools and to get journalists from all kinds of backgrounds that are from these communities that have been left behind or don't get the same degree of attention. That used to be the standard in newsrooms a generation ago, that the notion of being a journalist, even at a top publication, didn't necessarily mean you came from a very elite background, but that's more and more the case. And I think just the reality shows that there's a perspective, a sensibility that's being missed in a lot of coverage, not all the time, but some of the time in some of these leading publications. So I think that's a very important, the diversity of all kinds, very important in newsrooms. I also think that I also like to look at a lot of data and polling to keep me straight, but also to be, you know, skeptical too of you know, and make sure you get a good diversity of sources where you look at the numbers, you talk to sources on the ground. You don't just depend on just numbers. You don't just depend on insiders. You get a varied degree of sources and elements to how you inform your analysis. And also traveling to the states and districts and talking to voters, getting a sense of what people are saying, listening. I missed that in 2020. I think a lot of the coverage, frankly, about what happened down ballot in the Senate races and the House races where Republicans overperformed expectations, I think a lot of that could have been remedied if there was more travel. The pandemic shut things down. There wasn't a whole lot of coverage of some of the big candidates running for office. Susan Collins wasn't leading in any polls. She won by almost 10 points. I think if more reporters went to Maine and actually kind of focused on the campaign on the ground, talked to more voters, there would have been less of a disconnect between the analysis before the election and what happened. And that's not, I think a lot of that was pandemic related, but there's no substitute from talking to voters and listening to them in combination with reporting from folks in Washington and looking at the polling out there. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about what's been going on lately on Capitol Hill. Obviously, the decision was made by Texas Senator John Cornyn to lean into the gun issue in a way that personally I think is pretty risky going into a midterm election year in terms of the way that it could potentially undermine the strong level of support that Republican candidates, conservatives have been receiving and really, you know, highlight a split within the party. Now, I don't think that necessarily, you know, does significant damage in terms of undermining their capability of winning in November. But tell me a little bit about why this played out the way that it did and why Mitch McConnell, who is notoriously risk averse, was willing to go along with it.
Well, look, on the McConnell end of things, and then the reason you got 14 Republican senators to get on board is, I think, number one, there is a widespread, if you look at the polling, widespread public opinion in favor of something needs to be done on whether it's gun regulations and these are small scale gun regulations, a red flag. Provisions are the most controversial in this bill. You've got the mental health funding, you've got some security, school security funding as well. You know, I think for the broader public, this is not as polarizing, not as controversial as it is among elements of the Republican base. And I also think that there is like this, for people who aren't paying attention to politics, who aren't as engaged in the issues, they may have issues with both parties. They may be very supportive of the Second Amendment, but I also think they think Congress doesn't get anything done. There's a endless gridlock, and just showing that there can be bipartisan, constructive, potentially constructive solutions to some of the problems going on in the country. I think that is what Cornyn is looking at with championing this bill. For Cornyn, there's a lot of risk. I think it's less politically in Texas, Ben, than it is in leadership, because Mitch McConnell's not going to be leader of the party, you know, forever. And there's going to be a leadership fight. John Thune, who's running for re-election. There was some question of whether he was going to stay in the Senate, but he's in it for the long haul. Cornyn is a trusted lieutenant or former lieutenant of Senator McConnell. There's going to be a leadership fight, and I think this might advantage someone like John Thune, who is against the gun bill from a very conservative state like South Carolina. South Dakota, and Cornyn, this may be one of these issues that's used, you know, against him. Majority of Republicans voting against this legislation, including all the Republicans, or I think almost all the Republicans, with either national presidential ambitions or folks who are on the ballot in 2022. So, Cornyn is not up again until 2026 in Texas. I don't think this is going to be a driving issue by then. But I do think that he may have cost himself some capital in a future leadership fight.
Mm-hmm. Part of that has to do with the judgment call aspect of it. You know, like the way that the talk radio media, even though it's more than talk radio, will be talking about this in the coming months will be, you know, an aspect of betrayal, a feeling that, you know, you gave Biden a win, that kind of thing. Now, from my perspective, and I share your view on this, you know, that doesn't actually do anything to Cornyn if he decides to run again in 2026. It's hard to see him being beaten by a further right candidate. He's fended off that kind of challenge before. The issue is more, you know, kind of a, you know, was this the right judgment call for the morning, for the moment? Is this something that the Senate, including potentially the new members of it, will look to as an aspect of leadership, meaning something that could qualitatively benefit him? Oh, he's a way to have someone who could maybe get things done or have certain leadership qualities to him versus someone like Thune? Or is this really going to turn into an ideological scrum about, you know, do we want to have a leader who is more representative of where the party is as a whole on a lot of these issues, meaning someone who would presumably be to Cornyn's right, even if it's not on every aspect of policy?
My sense is it's more the latter, just because the trend lines are pretty clear within the Republican Party and within the future Republican Senate makeup. You have folks like Rob Portman, Pat Toomey, retiring and being replaced by, or likely being replaced by more conservative successors. J.D. Vance in Ohio. We'll see what happens with Dr. Oz, or if he even can win that seat in Pennsylvania. But there is an overall trend moving to the right more ideologically. And that's where the party is. That's where the voters are. So, you know, look, there are a lot of institutionalists still remaining and still will be in the Senate come 2023. But the trend lines are clear. The momentum is clear. And Thune has credibility, too. I mean, look, I hate the game out a leadership fight this early. There's going to be a lot of factors at play. But Thune also has that institutionalist credibility. He has some of the same good relationships that Cornyn does with key folks. I thought it was interesting, Rick Scott, who seems to be teasing a possible leadership fight and clashes increasingly with McConnell, putting himself in the ring, or at least, you know, opposing this and trying to thread the needle there as well. So it's going to be very... The future makeup of the Republican Party is going to really hinge on these midterm races coming up in 2022, whether more conservative, more pugnacious candidates end up winning in swing states, and whether that can change and push the Republican Party rightward going forward.
You know, a big part of that too, I think, is Scott's confidence in making some of these judgment calls where he and McConnell have split. You know, you saw that happen after January 6th, where McConnell was basically like, Trump's toast, you know, we're not going to be a party of him anymore, you know, et cetera. We're going to move on. And Scott basically made the decision to basically reject a lot of the be fine with losing some of the corporate dollars and things like that, and then make up for it in small dollar donations, which, you know, was his own judgment call there. But you also have to view that kind of through this lens of him, you know, tweaking McConnell and trying to push and put himself into a position to be considered as an alternative, especially as someone who is obviously an incredibly wealthy member of the Senate and has relationships with these very wealthy supporters of the right. It's just an interesting thing. And yes, it is early to game it out. But to me, the way that the Senate has functioned under McConnell has been so odd and kind of ahistorical. You know, both in terms of basically becoming an approval department for the judiciary as their primary goal, but also being, you know, a body that has a lot of people who really seem to dislike each other and don't have any hesitation anymore about making it known in a way that, you know, kind of breaks a little bit with the historic period that we had been through previously. In terms of these potential new additions to the Senate, who strikes you as being the most potentially disruptive, given that they can be disruptive in kind of different ways? But we all remember when Ted Cruz showed up, it was very clear that, like, he didn't care about any of the things that people were telling him that he needed to do in order to further the interest of the party. It was all about what Ted thought ought to happen. And he became a very disruptive force in a way that, say, some of the other Tea Partiers at the time were not necessarily. Who out of this current pool of people who are headed potentially toward Washington from the Republican side do you think could turn out to be the most disruptive?
Oh, I think J.D. Vance would fit that bill to a T if he wins the Senate race in Ohio. Mm-hmm. He is someone who understands the elite sensibilities, so to speak, but is running and has run a very aggressively populist campaign. And he has sort of the celebrity and the profile and the platform, frankly, to you know, play that role. Now, I think, look, he's got, I think, in Ohio, in this political environment, it's hard to see how he doesn't win, but he's had some headwinds of his own that he's going to have to face. And I think the results, whether he wins or loses, how much of the vote he gets in Ohio is going to be an early test of how this new brand of populism within the Republican Party is going to sell in a state like Ohio. I think, you know, if he only wins by a couple points, for example, that could be a warning sign that this maybe McConnell's right, that you need a broader, more market-tested appeal to a larger array of voters. But if Vance rides with the tide, wins by double digits against a pretty good Democratic candidate, you know, that could be an early indicator of where the Republican Party is headed. I would also add one thing about Rick Scott, who's the head of the National Republican Senatorial Committee. I think what he has to do is win back the Senate majority and not lose these critical races. I think just winning a seat and losing some very winnable races would not be a good sign for his leadership or his national ambitions. Like, ultimately, winning is the fundamental deodorant in politics. And if he can say, I took back the Senate, I got four seats, I got new candidates, fresh blood in the caucus, that's a huge momentum for him. But if he loses in Pennsylvania, if he loses in Arizona with some candidates that may not be ready for prime time, you know, I don't know if he can get off the ground. It's hard to make the case to conservatives if you can't win big races, if you can't win back the Senate majority.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about how you handicap the situation in Arizona, which is obviously now one of the remaining situations where you have some very different candidates in the mix for what everyone believes or believed prior to this was going to be, you know, a top tier Senate target for Republicans. But just given some of the problems that you have with each candidate, you know, there's a lot of, he could beat Mark Kelly, but kind of conversations going on, even to the point where I've heard, you know, more recently that, you know, Nevada may be actually a better target for them. But I'm curious as to your perspective on the different feasible candidates in terms of winning that nomination and a little more than a month from now.
Yeah, I mean, Arizona is a true swing state, maybe lean slightly Republican, but in this environment, it should be Republican. But there's a lot of concern about the caliber of candidates in that field. Trump just endorsed Blake Masters, who's also championed by Peter Thiel, the venture capitalist who supports sort of the supported J.D. Vance, sort of these populist conservative candidates. I still believe, like, the blocking and tackling of politics matters, that going on a podcast and saying controversial things can be damaging in a swing state, when these audio clips and TV clips get played back, and that being in your face may work for Trump, but I don't know if that translates to other candidates. So Master, there's a lot of you know, baggage, a lot of things he said that have been coming back to haunt him. We'll see if it matters, if he wins the nomination, if he can beat Mark Kelly as a result. But, you know, when you say that, you know, one of the more underrated thinkers, I believe is how it was phrased, that you would rate, is the Unabomber, and you say that on TV or on, you know, video, yeah, that's a problem. That's the kind of thing that might have even been disqualifying 5-6 years ago in politics. So, you know, and you also have other candidates. Mark Brnovich is the state attorney general who, you know, to put it mildly, isn't raising the money, isn't showing any real charisma or political aptitude to succeed like someone who's got that profile should. Mm-hmm. And you also have a third candidate, Jim Lehman, who's got a lot of money, self-funder, who's attacking Master. He seems to be someone who's going to rely on his money to get his name up there and try to win that primary. But I think there's a lot of questions about him as well and his general election positioning. And look, Mark Kelly, if you look at the polling, his numbers right now are pretty good. He's running well ahead of Biden. He's favorable, viewed much more favorably than Biden. He's got a lot of money that he's spending on ads that are deliberately trying to distance himself from the administration and declare his independence. And look, Ben, in politics, perception is reality. If you don't have money, if you can't get your own message out there, and you're letting your opposition define the race, that can make a big difference. So, you know, I do see Arizona and I see Georgia and I see a lot of these swing state races as races Republicans should win given this political environment. But I also believe that, especially in the Senate, candidates matter, and a bad candidate, someone who's not broadly acceptable, can lose a very winnable race.
Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that this is a that this turns out to be the Republican wave year that most people have thought it would be for the past several months. You look at these terrible poll numbers for Biden, and you assume that Republicans are basically going to spend the fall just tying every Democrat candidate to Biden and to his economic agenda and the like. Let's assume that they perform well and that you end up with a Senate that has J.D. Vance, Dr. Oz, Herschel Walker, you know, Adam Laxalt, and, you know, pick your Arizonan. And how does that change the makeup of the Senate conference, given that you're injecting a lot of new, younger, in most cases, faces, or fresher to politics faces, you know, people who don't have the record of being involved in politics at the federal level?
It would make leadership, whoever the leader is, McConnell or anyone else going forward, a lot more unwieldy. I mean, any one senator can really hold up business. We learned that with Ted Cruz, as you were talking about, Ben, earlier, back in the Tea Party days. But any one senator can have their own profile, their own platform, and they can, if they so choose to go in that direction, they could use it to be quite disruptive. So I do think, the majority of the Republican Senate lineup is still going to be establishment-oriented, institutional in its prerogatives. But the more J.D. Vance is, the more Blake Masters, if he wins, the more Oz, I think, is more of a wild card, Herschel Walker a little more of a wild card. But the more folks like that, Eric Greitens is being talked about as a possible senator because of the weird nature of that primary in Missouri. I mean, it's hard to believe, and he's got other issues, obviously, but
to say the least.
I mean, he's, but like having a domestic, an alleged domestic abuser, someone who is literally like, you know, could blow up the institution figuratively. That's a problem. It's hard to lead. It's hard to manage. It's going to be much more unwieldy for McConnell and future Republican leaders going forward.
So I want to move away from the Senate just to talk about the situation for President Biden at the moment. It seems to be something that just is getting worse every day. And the White House really doesn't seem to have a good response to the different stories that are cropping up across the country. They'll complain about things. They'll point fingers, but they don't seem to have a lot of solutions that are very tangible for people. And when they do tend to offer them, people seem to almost immediately find the problems with them as answers. Why has the White House not adjusted now versus, you know, waiting until after the election when you presume a lot of adjustment will happen? You know, there are people who are out there saying the White House needs to change direction all over the place, you know, not just on the right, but on the left, of course, as well. And they don't seem to really be listening. Why is that? And is it just a sort of basis in Biden's personal loyalty to these people? Or is there something else going on there? Because every political bone in your body seems to indicate that this is a time when you ought to be making some changes in your priorities and in the way that you're approaching these issues.
Yeah, so number one is Biden is a very loyal principal. He's a loyal boss, and he doesn't believe in just, you know, shaking up his team just for the sake of shaking things up. Now, I do think that there are some severe liabilities that certain folks have. Or you just look at the record, being slow to react to the inflationary evidence all around us. It took forever to realize this is a problem. The BBB mess and divisions within their own party. I mean, the list goes on and on. It's been a very reactive administration. It's been an administration that's kind of living in its own bubble, and many times far to the left of where the average American is. And yeah, I mean, you would think that there needs to be a shakeup. Now, there's not much that a shakeup would do before the midterm elections. The cake is baked. That's not going to change things dramatically or even incrementally. So I can understand why he just wants to wait it out till the midterms. I think they understand this is a very tough election cycle. The bigger issue isn't, I mean, it is personnel. I think they could use, like Bill Clinton did in 1994, 1995, some independent thinkers, some more moderate thinkers, bring Roy Teixeira, who's been you know, writing a very persuasive newsletter for the last year. He's a fellow at the Center of American for American Progress, saying, look, you are on cultural issues, you're way out of step with the American people, even with a lot of folks in your own party. You've got to course correct. And, you know, just today, that some of these Title IX expansions and some of the rhetoric coming from the administration doesn't seem to get it. They don't seem to understand that there is a cultural disconnect that's hurting them badly with a whole swath of voters. But that aside, like, Bill Clinton showed that he could take it on the chin in a midterm and then course correct. To some extent, Obama in the run-up to 2012 did the same thing. In my reporting and my writing about this administration, there is a bigger bubble effect. That there are some folks that do understand that they need to move ideologically, but a lot of people think it's just the messaging, or it's just the staff, or it's just get some more young people that are outsiders, and then maybe they'll have a better idea. And there is fundamentally an ideological challenge where the party and the leadership and the folks who have a lot of high positions in this administration just don't get that culturally, on social issues, cultural issues, they are well to the left of where most Americans are.
No, I think that's such an important thing to recognize. And unfortunately, it's one that it seems to me that they didn't recognize until it was too late, this was actually a key element of Joe Biden's appeal that kept that coalition together. When you look at some of these poll numbers, what's something that sticks out to you as being a big indicator of how bad things have gotten for them?
Well, look, if Biden doesn't run for real, he says he's going to run for re-election. If he doesn't run for re-election, his heir apparent, Vice President Harris, has even worse numbers than he does. That is the subtext to a lot of this conversation about, does Biden run again and what's the future of the Democratic Party? Because the prospect of having someone who would be 86 at the end of his second term running for re-election, showing clear decline, I mean, he's clear decline, at a time when the economy looks like it's going to be in a recession throughout 2023, or at least there's a good chance that's the case. I mean, that is a very unappealing prospect. That's when you have an LBJ situation where the president steps aside, or, you know, H.W. Bush is I think the environment was actually better for H.W. Bush than what we're looking like in 2023, 2024, but, you know, his numbers went from the 80s to the 30s and 20s even, in the run-up to his re-election bid. So the notion that Biden at his age and with the reality around him, it's just hard to see him running again, even if he wants to. But the thing that you hear worry about from Democratic officials is if he doesn't run, it's going to be a civil war within the party. Harris is going to run. She retains some institutional support, but her political aptitude, her political numbers are very poor. And that would create a nasty primary centered on identity lines, ideological lines, that could get ugly and ugly at a time when the party is already going to be taking it on the chin.
Mm-hmm. Let's go out on this. I think that one of the things that sticks out to me in this moment is that in America, when you step back from just sort of the day to day, even if you're not engaged in the political scene, there seems to be a distinct level of unease, a feeling that things are getting worse and could kind of go off a cliff very rapidly. And you have that feeling about the economic news. You have that feeling, I would say, about a lot of supply chain issues and shortages. You know, people, regular people saying, you know, I don't get how, you know, in America we can have a baby formula shortage, or, you know, any of the other things that they're looking at. There seems to me to be this degree of kind of running along the edge of a cliff. I wonder if that's something that you can see, or if you share that opinion, or if you disagree with it. Because to me, that's a very dangerous circumstance, because it tends to lead people to potentially overreact to things that are going on around them, in the sense that things are bad. They look, a lot of different measures, they look very bad, but they also, you know, have the potential here to be worse than it actually is on paper, simply because of people's overreaction to them in a period where they feel a real lack of leadership from Washington and from the folks who are making significant decisions. Is that something that you feel is going on as well?
You know, there is always overreaction, especially in our age of social media. It's easy to have the snap decision and the snap criticism and not take into context the larger picture. But boy, I mean, even taking that out of the equation, this is about as much of a malaise that the American public has felt in quite some time, probably at least going back to the recession of 2008. When you look at the right track, wrong track numbers, you look at, is the country headed on the right track? You know, how do you feel individually about your own personal circumstances? All those numbers are at pretty low ebbs, and they're not improving for the party in power. So, and again, I think things, I'm not an economist. I listen to folks like Larry Summers and, you know, smart folks who are on the front lines, and they seem to think the worst is yet to come as interest rates go up and as growth slows and unemployment's going to have to, you know, go up. I think things can get worse. Like, I think Biden's like 40% or so job approval rating right now could go down into the low 30s. He's already showing softness with his own base. And if the economy is in a recession, or, you know, if we have a real extended lull, that could, you know, really cost him, not just with swing voters and certainly Republicans, but with even some core Democratic voting blocks. And he's not shown the vibrancy or the charisma or the leadership skills to get himself out of the ditch that he's in right now. So, I mean, I am more on the pessimistic side of things, in terms of just how I don't think the public mood is going to get better. I think, you know, one way of, you know, turning things around is just showing energetic leadership from the bully pulpit. And we're not seeing that, from the White House, and certainly the objective indicators are very, very pessimistic and very dismal right now.
Josh, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks, Ben.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast right after this. Personally, I think it's very interesting that John Cornyn made the decision that he did when it came to the gun issue. It's one that I think is potentially very risky for him for a lot of different reasons. And, you know, one thing in particular is that the gun issue is one that has notoriously been kind of a third rail culture war issue, that basically, if you squish out on that issue, it's taken as an indication that you can't be trusted on a number of others. I would, you know, include the category of both immigration and abortion in those spaces as well. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, you saw when Donald Trump came along, his unwillingness to go down that road in any real respect. It was a way for him to really help with the culture war cred that he established as president on his right flank. I'll be curious to see whether there are long-term ramifications, not just for Cornyn, but for some of the other members as well. Keep in mind, several of them have the potential to be retiring in the coming years. You know, others are obviously not up for re-election. But it does say something that you had the level of support that was given to this 14 different Republicans in the Senate going along with it. You also, of course, see the opposition from people like Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise on the House side. And I don't think that that's a surprise either. You know, one of the things that is important, I think, in this moment is to navigate these issues responsibly and to do so in a way that brings people along, as opposed to, you know, barring the door for them to have any kind of consideration. It was very telling that someone like Mike Lee on Fox News Sunday was very critical of Cornyn's approach, in part because he didn't get a chance to look at the legislation before it was ever brought forward, something that has been, of course, you know, a way that the Senate has worked now for quite some time, but is not necessarily historically the way that things were done. It does not brook any kind of trust among the senators to have something pushed entirely through the media and not actually try to get them to come along with it in any respect. There was also a pretty strong response from Florida Senator Rick Scott, as we noted, that really rejected a lot of it, particularly because he advanced gun policies as governor in Florida that have some similarities, but have some key differences when it comes to red flag laws and other aspects of what's been going on. So it's an issue that bears watching, and certainly one that does not do a lot to hold things together when it comes to the gun issue on the right. But I think that this issue is also, in part due to the success of the gun lobby, a far less pressing issue for people who don't really believe that in the post-Heller era, they're going to lose their handguns, they're going to lose, you know, they're going to see the kind of gun grabbing that the courts have traditionally not allowed. And the Supreme Court just this day put out a major decision authored by Clarence Thomas that, you know, again, rebuts the kind of leftist argument on gun rights that we saw coming out in this case of New York State. In part, this is an area where the right has been helped by the left's extremes on the issue. The fact that they have gone so hard against weapons that are so popular and so widely available to Americans has been a key factor here. Instead of perhaps making more narrow targets that would make the left less happy, but be more feasible. I'm Ben Domenech. You're listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.